So when Dave asked me to give a series of talks on a conference on the Langmuir's program and gauge theory, I said, well, okay, but I don't actually know anything about the Langmuir's program and gauge theory. And he said, well, okay, that's fine. Instead, you can give a series of talks on D-brains. So that's what I'll be doing. So if any of you ask me any questions about what all this stuff has to do with the Langmuir's program, I'm not going to be able to answer it. Okay. That's a forewarning. Okay, so what am I going to try and cover in these talks? Well, as I said, it's going to be D-brains, and it's going to all be in the context of topological field theory. And it's been known for some time. That these fall into two types. There are A brains and B brains associated with the A type topological field theory and the B type topological field theory. And it is now believed that these things are described by a thing called the Fekaya category. Perhaps I should put derived in brackets. And the B brains are described by a thing called the derived category coherent sheaves, or just the derived category for short. and we have mirror symmetry relating these two. Now, my belief, I think most people agree, some people are. Might differ, is that this side is extremely difficult, and this side is easy. Well, easy relative to that side, at least. So I'm going to focus most of my talks here on the B-brain side, and if you want to know anything about A-brains, you then use the mirror map to get from the right-hand side to the left-hand side. So the focus of these talks will be on B-type B-brain. Now, when I first thought what I'd talk about, I thought, well, okay, perhaps I could give a pedagogical step-by-step proof that B-brains are indeed defined by the bounded derived category of coherent sheaves. But then I thought that would probably take more than three talks and would be kind of dull, and it's appeared in various forms in various papers anyway. I tried to do a version of this back in some notes that I wrote from some Tarsi lectures back in 2003, so I reference people to that if they want to know more details in the background of what I'll be doing. So instead, what I thought was that I'd give just one lecture on why B brains are defined by the derived category, which means I'm not going to be rigorous. I'm just going to do some rough hand-waving argument why this works. And then the next talk will be more of more along the lines of useful tools that you can use in this context. I always think that the great thing about the fact that B-brains are defined by the derived category is not that you've got some abstract math working for you. It's that you can actually calculate things very practically in the derived category. So this is an extremely useful tool. So I'll try and convince you in the second and third lecture that indeed it is a great fact. It isn't just some abstract mathematical nonsense that B-brains are defined by this, but it's actually useful. So this will be a basic derivation, a rough derivation of the derived category. The second talk I'm going to focus on using quivers to describe B-brains in the context of the derived category. And the last talk, I'll use matrix factorization. So the second and third lecture will be a kind of user's guide to B-brains in the derived category. Okay. So I'm going to do a lightning review of some fairly old stuff of the B-type topological field theory, well, the A-type and the B-type. This description goes back to Witten in HEPS theory 9112056. And the basic idea is that you start with an n equals 2 comma 2 superconformal field theory. And this is associated to a sigma model mapping a world sheet into some target space X, where X is going to be some Taylor manifold. It may or may not be compact, but when we get to the quivers, we'll be doing a non-compact X. For simplicity, you can think of X being compact, at least at first. And because it's a supersymmetric, is it okay to erase this? So let me just list what the contents of the field theory is in terms of the fermions. So I have an A model and a B model. And we have our fermions in this. I'll use plus and minus as a subscript to denote the left movers and the right moving fermions. And these take values in the tangent bundle of our target space manifold X, which is Kähler. So I have holomorphic and anti-holomorphic indices for the holomorphic tangent bundle and the anti-holomorphic tangent bundle. So these are our fields psi. And these are spinners on the world sheets in the n equals 2 comma 2 superconformal field theory, but then we do a topological twist, and they become sections of the following bundle. So K is the canonical bundle on the world sheet, K sigma. So that's what we do in the A model. That's the bundle that these things take value in the A model. And in the B model, you do a different twist. And we have this. Okay. And we have an anomaly, at least in the B model, which forces the first gen class of the tangent bundle to be zero. So at least in this simple case, we know that X is a Calabi-Yau Kähler and vanishing first gen class. Okay, so we analyze this. And in the B model, so first, we just do close things. We think of a world sheet sigma as a Riemann surface with no boundary. We analyze the B model, and we find that the operators, the BRST operator of the topological field theory looks like D bar. Closed-string vertex operators are elements of Dolbo cohomology, and exterior powers in the tangent. So these, if you like, are the Hilbert spaces of closed-string. This is a finite-dimensional vector space. So they're a bit like PQ forms. If I take an exterior powers of the cotangent bundle, then these would be PQ forms, but I'm taking exterior powers of the tangent bundle instead. And you can do the same thing for the A model. And you discover that in that case, you just get the Rahm cohomology. But I won't go through the details of that. And that's it for closed things, as far as I'm concerned. OK, now we try and put in D-brain. Well, what's a D-brain? Well, a D-brain is associated with boundaries of the world sheet. A D brain is where an open string can end. So if I start thinking of sigma as being the Riemann surface with a boundary, then I now have to consider what those boundary conditions are, and those are D brains. And I'm going to be really crude here, just to get to the answer as quickly as I can. So, if I think of Z as being the holomorphic coordinates on the world sheet, then a boundary condition I might write is this. Basically, the left movers have to be constrained with respect to the right movers if I have a boundary, so I need some condition on the boundary. So I'm going to say it. So Rij is just some matrix. So the left moving objects get identified with the right moving objects on the boundary. That's a boundary condition. And you can phrase this in terms of Dirichlet and Neumann boundary conditions. And a plus one eigenvalue for R, I claim is the same thing as a Neumann boundary condition. And a minus one eigenvalue for R is a Dirichlet boundary condition. Sorry about the noisy blackboard. Okay. Well, we need to put in boundary conditions to preserve at least some of the supersymmetry that we had. I can't preserve all the supersymmetry because I've got n equals 2 left moving and n equals 2 right moving supersymmetry. And now there's the left movers and right movers are getting mixed on the boundary. But I can try and preserve the diagonal n equals 2 inside this n equals 2 comma 2. Or equivalently, once I've twisted the topological field theory, when I'm looking at the topological field theory, I'd like to preserve the BRSD symmetry that I have. So in order to do that, I need to constrain the psis as well as the phis in a suitable way. So let's try. Here's where I'm being a bit quick because there are more general things I can do than this. Oh, by the way, just one thing in notation. If I use a uppercase letter I and J, that will stand for either a holomorphic or anti-holomorphic index, or equivalently a real index. So let's try doing this with the same matrix. That would seem like a good guess. If I use R to mix the phi, perhaps I can use the same R to mix the psi. Well, let's split this equation into holomorphic and anti-holomorphic indices again. And I can see that because of the twist, well, if I look at example of the A model, the psi plus I is in a pullback of the tangent sheaf. Obviously, I can't mix that with the second or third line because they live in completely different bundles. I can mix it with the last line because at least on the boundary I can identify the tangent sheaf, the tangent bundle with the cotangent bundle. So I could mix the first kind of fermion with the last kind and the second with the third kind. So in the A model, I can write R as a matrix with zeros like that, where, if you like, this is the holomorphic part, this is the anti-holomorphic part. So R must look like that to be consistent with the twist that I had up there. Now, X is Kähler, so X is therefore almost complex. So it has an almost complex structure. I'll write as J, which is in holomorphic and anti-holomorphic coordinates looks like that. Okay. Oh, sorry, do you have a question? Yeah, I can. Oh, have I got a typo here? Yeah, sorry, I think I might have a typo. I'll just check my notes. I may have copied it down wrong. No, sorry, I think it's right. Sure. Yeah, right, it's the thetas. I mean, it's written as theta, zetas, and... I know, that's what I can't remember if that's correct or not. I think it is correct. No, because they differ by the k. I think if we take a quick look at Whitman's paper, let me see it straight away. I can't remember. I mean, I think there are thetas. Right. Well, anyway, we can resolve this quickly if we look at the witness paper. I can. Okay, so we see from these matrices here that R anti-commutes with J, which implies that J exchanges the plus and minus R eigenvalues. And remember, R was the thing that told us, I just erased it, whether we have Neumann or Dirichlet boundary conditions. Well, the D-brain is defined as the thing that the open string is forced to end on. So the directions tangents to the D-brain will have eigenvalue minus 1, and the directions which are normal will have eigenvalue plus 1. They get exchanged by the almost complex fraction. That immediately implies that D brain are Lagrangian submodules. So this is for the A model. Okay. In the A model, I got that. So I've derived the fact that you get Lagrangian submodules for the A type. Now I can do almost the same thing for the B model. Because the definition of a Lagrangian submanifold is the thing where if I restrict the Kähler form to it, it becomes zero. So that's the same thing as saying that the almost complex structure are sort of all of the things that you count as, how does this work? Let's say that we write the complex numbers as z equals x plus iy. Which are dictated by J. The Lagrangian basically has all of its tangent directions in the x directions and all the normal directions in the y directions, which is the same thing as saying that J exchanges the x and the x's and the y's. So, yeah, I want to do the same thing for the B model. It's almost the same, except of course now R looks like this. This is B model. now R becomes diagonal, and when I do that, I get that RJ, R commutes with J, which implies that J preserves the plus and minus the R eigenvalue. I say eigenvectors minus the R eigenvectors, which immediately implies that D brains are holomorphic somehow. Because again, if I write my holomorphic coordinates Z as X plus IYs, then now X being tangent to a D brain means that Y is tangent to a T. So I have a holomorphic submanifold for a D brain. Okay, so there's the quick and rough way of proving that A brains are Lagrangian and B brains are holomorphic. Now, what I've done is not completely general, because I've put in a guess for what the size has to be. This equation at the top of the blackboard is not the most general thing that I could have considered, but it certainly works. So in general, you might worry that there might be more B brains that you've missed. And indeed, if you look at things like the sixth torus, then you would discover that there are more than just Lagrangian submanifolds. There are the co-associative manifolds. And that's exactly what I've missed by that guess at the top. But for a Calabi-Yau threefold, co-isotropic, thank you. For the things like a Calabi-Yau threefold, which is what we'll be mainly interested in, these are all of the three brains. They're either Lagrangian in the A type, or, well, will be associated, after a long story of the direct capacity, which I'll get to, with things that basically started out as holomorphic submanifolds. Well, I guess not. I don't think you really know anything about the A model when it comes down to it, in a rigorous sense. But it is believed that there are no more. Okay, so I said at the start that A models are described by the Foucault-Cass group. So the A brains are described by the Foucault-Cass group, and B brains are defined by the derived category. I've claimed that the B-type B brains are holomorphic submanifolds. How do I get to the derived category from that? That's what I'll do next. So, for example, a B-type D brain can cover the whole of X. X itself is certainly a holomorphic submanifold of X. So I just have the whole manifold as a D brain. In other words, I have Neumann boundary conditions everywhere. So let's assume that's what we do, and we'll discover that we get the lower dimensional subspaces for free in some sense. So let's assume that a D brain covers the whole of X. I can add a little bit more freedom. I can add things that are called Champeyson factors. We obtain actually a holomorphic vector bundle. Again, I'll refer to Witten's paper for the details of how to do this, but basically, you can add in boundary terms in the action. When I define my quantum field theory, normally you think of the action as being associated to something integrated over the world sheet. Well, I can also add in terms which are just integrals over the boundary of the world sheet. And I've got some fields, I've got some things up here that look like one forms, so I could integrate those one forms over the boundary, and that would give me contributions to the action. I can write down that the action I get. And basically, these extra bits of I've added onto the action look like holomorphic vector bundles. Well, they look like vector bundles. Then when I impose that there's a BRST symmetry, that implies that they're holomorphic vector bundles. So these are associated to boundaries. Basically, you've got some fermions up here that I can use as one forms. You stick a coefficient in front of those one forms, and that coefficient becomes the connection on a vector bundle. Okay, so now E brain will be a vector bundle E over. Again, I can analyze exactly what the open string vertex operators look like. I analyzed the closed string, well, I didn't. I told you that I had written, analyzed the closed string vertex operators and got that they were these elements of Dalbo cohomology living in exterior powers of the tangent bundle. Now what we discover so if I'm in this case where I just have a vector bundle covering the whole of X, so all boundaries of my world sheet are associated with this one D brain, then I discover that these are elements of Dalbo cohomology 0Q again, pretty similar to the last time, except now they're valued in endomorphisms of E. That's where I'm living now. So that was for a single D brain. Well, it's not very hard to then generalize this. If we have two D brains, which are both vector bundles over the whole space, let's call them E and F, then an open string, which if you like starts at E and ends at F, lie in H del bar 0Q X, and basically we have the HOM into F. Or I could write this as E dual into F. So those are the open strings that start at E and end at F. We have a there's an orientation on the world sheet, which means that open strings going from E to F are not necessarily the same thing as open strings going from F to E. So this is not necessarily symmetric with respect to exchanges E and F. Now, in this topological field theory, we have a conserved number in all the correlation functions, and this is the so-called ghost number. This is the same thing as the as the U1 charge that came from the original n equals 2 comma 2 superconformal field theory. This is the ghost number observation. So the ghost number of an open string in this is simply Q, which is not surprising. It's not hard to prove. You just have to work out what the ghost numbers of the fermions are that I have, and you discover that they're ghost number one, basically, and you use Q of them to build the open string vertex operator. Um, Okay, so if I have an open string, this is the important bit. If I have an open string that begins and ends on the same V-brain, and it lies in this group, I can tell you I can tell you for certainty that its ghost number is Q. What about an open string in a thing where I don't necessarily begin and end on the same thing? So I start at E and I end on F. Well, we'd like to think that the ghost number's got something to do with Q, but it also can depend on what E and F are. Now, all we really demand of a ghost number is that it be a symmetry of the topological field theory. I am free to associate a ghost number with the D-brain. And so I'm going to call this ghost number mu. So if I have a vector bundle E, I'm going to call its ghost number mu. Then this has a ghost number. U plus whatever the ghost number of E was, minus the ghost number of F. And if I do that, then my ghost number is still a symmetry of the topological field theory. Now, okay, I've phrased it one way. I've said that I'm free to declare ghost numbers on the D-brains and preserve this symmetry. I can phrase it a different way. We know that this topological field theory came from a twisted n equals 2 comma 2 superconformal field theory. And I know that the ghost numbers in the superconformal field theory came from the U1 charges. I could go back to the superconformal field theory and calculate what the U1 charge of this open string is. And what you discover is that it depends on B plus IJ. It depends on the Kähler form of X, which is something that the topological field theory does not depend on. So the U1 charge of this open string is something that the topological field theory is, in a sense, not allowed to know about, because it can vary with something that it doesn't know about. So you kind of have to put this degree of freedom in there. You're definitely cheating if you don't allow these degrees of freedom on the boundary. As I said, I'm free to add this degree of freedom and still conserve the ghost number. Now, this is an important step. Oh, and I should also add that if we did the A model instead, if we did Lagrangian submanifolds and I tried to work out the degree of the Fleur cohomology groups, because that's what it would be in that case, there's a well-known problem with assigning the degree of these Fleur groups. And in order to make life easier, people associate numbers to the Lagrangian submanifold in exactly the same way as I've done it here. So you can also argue this point from the mirror map and looking at the A-type brains, but I certainly don't have time to do that here. Okay, anyway, I claim that all of this combines to form a category that I'll call the D-brain category. So how do we define this exactly? Well, the objects in this category are the D-brains themselves. So in the category as I've defined it so far, these are nothing but holomorphic vector bundles. The morphisms Hilbert spaces. Well, I say Hilbert spaces, but they're always going to be finite dimensional spaces in the context of topological field. Well, actually, that's not true, because I might do things on a non-compact space. But at least if X is compact, these are going to be finite dimensional. And I said that these morphisms, they're associated to some ghost number. I may as well restrict to Q is zero for the following reason. Because I can just find out the other possible values of Q, and the fact that I've got this integer associated to the deep rings themselves. So let us associate ghost number, so let us denote a ghost number shift by square brackets. So what I mean by that is that if you give me a D brain with a certain ghost number, I'm going to tell you I have another D brain where I simply shift that ghost number by n. So every vector bundle has this additional has an additional integer degree of freedom that I'm calling the ghost number. And I'm just going to denote a shift of that ghost number by square bracket. So in that case, POM of POM's going to be everything. Sent So, in order to find out what the ghost number Q, what the degree Q cohomology open string vertex operators are associated with open strings in either F, I simply look at the ghost number 0, 1, that I shift F by Q. So I'm just playing with notation here. I'm not doing anything more profound. But what I'm saying is that these morphisms will only be the Q is 0 bit. We'll just do the 0 Dolbo cohomology. So I claim this forms a category. I've told you what the objects are, and I've told you what the morphisms are. I need to tell you how to compose morphisms. I do actually in this case. Yeah. Now there are D brains which are not, but we're going to get those later. For now, I'm just talking about D-brains that cover the whole of X. So it really is a vector bundle. The morphisms, so compositional morphisms. Right. I'm saying that the only submanifold that we're going to consider for now is X itself. We'll get the others back for free at the end. All I'm going to consider right now are just the D brains that cover the whole of it. So how do I compose two morphisms? Well, you can do this in the language of the topological field theory. You can look at the correlation function. So I could do something like, I could think of a bunch of open strings coming in. And going into nothing, going into a vacuum. And this, of course, is the same thing as a correlation function. So I can compute what these diagrams are supposed to look like in the language of topological field theory. And one of them in particular is just mapping a single vertex operator into nothing. Now, of course, this has to have a boundary condition. Let's call the boundary condition lowercase a. This is a boundary condition, i.e. it's a D-brain. And here I've got my call it VAA. So I've got open strings coming in, and they're going nowhere. So an open string is a open string from boundary condition A to boundary condition A. And this is going to nowhere, which is just the complex numbers. So this is associated to a map from VAA to the complex numbers, where VAA is some guy that looks like that. And this map is ghost number. Minus D, where D is the dimension of S. One thing you've got to worry about is the ghost number of the vacuum itself when you compute this, when you compute correlation functions in this topological field theory. And it turns out that the ghost number of the vacuum is minus the dimension of the target space. Well, you can calculate what this map is. And it turns out to be nothing more than Serre duality. Well, what does Serre duality tell us? It tells us that HOD and E is isomorphic to H00. And of course, there's a canonical element of this group on the right given by 1. So if I take an element of this group, I can see what multiple of what it maps to. And that's exactly this map from V to the complex numbers. So you can compute what a one-point function is. And so duality. Which means that I can then compute what a two-point function is. And it turns out this is wedge product followed by search value. So what you do is you take the two open string vertex operators, you combine them by using a wedge product, then you take the map here. The resulting thing is mapped to the complex numbers. But anyway, this turns out to be a perfect pairing. Which means that I can identify a space of operators, essentially with a dual. Which means that when I look at the three-point function, I can do one of three-point functions. I can rewrite this as VAB and so VBC goes to VBC. Because I can identify that with a dual. And this is composition of morphic. Which which I can think of alternatively as a diagram of the pointless. So if I compose these open strings, I compose morphisms. When I originally started giving these talks, I sort of dwelling on this a much longer time and going into Graham Segal and Greg Moore's version of topological field theory, you can get a very big and nice story out from all this stuff. This is just the tip of the iceberg of what you can do in this concept. All we really need to know is that the topological field theory contains enough information to define the composition of morphisms in the category of Dbread. Okay. This, as I said, is essentially given by wedge product. So, if we were just concerned with topological field theories of local operators, then I've told you that it's all contained in a D-brain category. All the correlation functions are basically contained in the composition of morphisms. And the only other piece of information that I need to calculate anything is exactly the form of Serre duality here. And that can be encoded in a thing called the Serre functor in the category. And that's it. That is essentially the content of at least the correlation functions of the local operators in the topological field theory. So we could stop there and say that that's it. But I haven't really told you about everything I can do to a D-brain yet. In particular, I can consider the notion of combining D-brains. Now we know, I guess, starting with work at SEN, that if we get two D-brains with an open string between them, that open string might look like a tachyon, and then we can somehow condense that tachyon, combine those two D-brains into one D-brain. So as well as combining open strings, I should also have some mechanism in my story for combining D-brains via tachyon condensate. So can we add the structure onto the D-brain category that I just defined? So given an open string, and let's say that it's in, I seem to have switched to using lowercase letters for D-brain. Sorry about that. Of course, the zeroth-dimensional Dalbo cohomology is nothing more than a holomorphic map, so I'm just going to consider open strings to be holomorphic maps from now on. And we condense the tachyon to bind A and B. Now, if I had a superconformal filter, I could look at the mass of F, and if it's negative mass squared, then it's certainly a tachyon, and I can do this. Now, whether or not this F is negative mass squared or not depends on the complexity by Taylor form, which, as I said, is information that the topological field theory doesn't know about. So the topological field theory doesn't know whether this is a tachyon or not. So what I'm going to do is to assume that it's always a tachyon. I mean, I've got to think of the possibility of combining every possible D-brain, because I don't know if the open string between them is a tachyon or not. So let's just try combining everything that we possibly can. And what I'm going to end up with is a set of D-brains which is too big in some sense. I mean, it will contain every possible physical D-brain, but it's going to contain a whole lot more because I've been condensing tachyon. I've been condensing open strings, which may never be a tachyon. But this is the best thing I can do if I'm purely restricting my attention to topological field theory. Okay, so let C be the resulting combination. Well, if you're a mathematician, then you'll recognize the answer I give, because I'm going to give the mathematical version of what this is. So I don't feel the need to explain the physical language, because I'm about to turn it into math language. Okay. So I'm going to write this as a triangle. A goes to B. So I have a map F from A to B, and I'm just going to denote this for reasons that will become clear as a triangle. For reasons which will also become clear, I'll stick a square bracket 1, because after all, this wasn't the statement of the symmetric. I'm building C from A and B, so I better say that one of these corners is special. So that's going to be the statement that A combines with F, A combines with B by the fact on F to form C. So why did I write it in this weird triangle? Lost my eraser. Oh, no. Well, the first thing I should notice is that I don't really end up with A plus B in any sense, because suppose A was equal to B. If I look at a tachyon, which is the field essentially equal to the identity, if I take 1, which is on AA, then it looks like a tachyon. And if I condense it, what I end up with is nothing. A combines, it turns out, with anti-A to give nothing. So what this really is not A combining with B, but it's really anti-A combining with B. I mean, that's what tachyon condensation does when you analyze it carefully. So this is anti-A plus B is C. And as I said, I know that because I know that there's the following triangle, where this is the identity. So that's definitely a triangle. Well, how might we go about adding A to B in a genuine sense rather than adding anti-A to B? Well, supposing I didn't take a tachyon condensation at all, supposing I just took A and B and I take the direct sum, I just add them together in a very crude sense. So suppose I have a vector bundle E and a vector bundle F. I can just take the direct sum. I can naively compute all of these open string Hilbert spaces, and I'll definitely get an answer. And that's a crude version of E with F. Well, if there is a tachyon lurking in there and I let it condense, then obviously what I'll end up with is some deformation of E plus F. Well, if someone asked you to work out a deformation of E plus F, what you'd probably think of as being an extension. And if I spent all 3 lectures working on this, I would tell you why it is an extension. But let's just assume that if I genuinely add E to F and do a tachyon condensation, what I get is an extension G, which is a deformation of E plus F. Yeah. Well, that's what I'm going to get to, yeah. So this, therefore, comes from X1 of FE. So the genuine way that I add 2 D brains together is to use an X1. If I use a HOM, then I'm just getting B plus anti-A. Well, if C is B plus anti-A, then obviously B is A plus C. And I get this from a map. C to A shifted by 1 because I needed the x, and the x I get by taking h 0 comma 1, so I'm shifting my what I call q only by 1. So this is a map from theta a shifted by 1. And now if I write that as a triangle, I therefore write it as this. So if I have a triangle that looks like, if I have a triangle that looks like that, then I claim that this is also a triangle.
Now, what if you have x1 of x2 rather than x1 of dx?
Well, that's just the definition of x, right? I mean,
f prime plus
dx. Theta a. If I look at this short exact sequence, so b is a plus c, then this short exact sequence, so b is a, g is b, and f is c. Yeah. I think it works. Okay, so that's one rule for these triangles. But if that's a triangle, then that's a triangle. It's not, as it turns out. And that's the problem with using the word anti, is that an anti-anti-D brain in this language is not the D brain that you started with. So that's one of the places where I'm cheating slightly. So I said I'd be waving my hands a little bit, and that's one place where I'm cheating. Well, that's where I'm being vague. I was saying that I knew that if I took something and I did a tachyon condensation with itself, I ended up with nothing whatsoever if I used a harm. So somehow, that harm was an A plus an anti-A gives me nothing. And that's the only definition of anti that I've given here. But as I said, but as Greg pointed out, there's a slight problem with taking it too literally, because if I do that twice, I get A shifted by 2, which is not the same thing as A. And it's one of the tricky points, which would take me a long time to not have problems with here. But I promised at the start this would be a rough derivation of the drive cascade. So what else do we know? Well, I can think of adding three D brains together, and I can think of the associativity of combining three brains. Combining three D brains. Okay, and basically, you write the following diagram. So that says that E is B plus E. So E is B plus D. That's that triangle. Then suppose I have another triangle. Which says that B is A plus C, which of course that means that E is A plus C plus C. Okay. Where I did that, but you'd expect such combinations, such ways of combining D brains to be associative. Let me combine it that way instead and call F equal to D plus C. So now I have a new D brain F down here, and if I write in the triangles for that, I would get these. And down here. I get that. So this octagon expresses the associativity of the ways of combining these D-brains. So this is the so-called octahedral axiom. Octahedral axiom. which says that given two distinguished triangles given in the form of solid lines, I can add two more distinguished triangles given with a dotted line such that everything in sight commutes. That's the same thing as saying that the act of combining three D-brains is associative. So I've proven that my rules for adding D-brains obey this condition, that if I have that, then I have the other triangle, and it has to satisfy the octahedral axiom. Okay, so I have a category that satisfies these rules. And that is that the D-brain category is what's called a triangulated category. Saying it's a triangulated category is the same as saying that it satisfies those rules. Okay, so now in a position to give the punchline, just on time. We first said that the D-brain category is a category given by holomorphic bundles. Is the category of holomorphic bundles a triangulated category? Well, no, it is not. We need to find more D-brains to be able to complete this category of holomorphic vector bundle. In order to get a triangulated category. And you know exactly how to do it because you know how to form these triangles. I said that we form these triangles by using the extra ones, basically. You go ahead and do it, and you discover you obtain the derived category. Sorry? Yeah, okay, yeah, sorry. Okay, so let's assume that X is the projective, but like this is. You obtain the derived category. So the bounded drive category. Okay, here it is. Okay. So suppose I should give the definition of the bounded drive category. I'm running out of time. I'll see if I can spill over to next time a little bit. But the basic idea is that there are. Well, first of all, notice that I haven't said the bounded drive category of vector bundles. Actually, that wouldn't make sense. What I've got is the bounded drive category of coherent sheaves. So, in particular, I've added coherent sheaves. So they must be D-brains. Well, what's the obvious way of getting a D-brain that's a coherent sheaf? Let's consider the trivial line bundle. That was one of our vector bundles. And consider another line bundle whose first term class is, say, minus D, where D is a device. Subspace of complex codimension 1. Okay. Then if I do that, I can form a short exact sequence, which will give me a triangle of the following form. Where OD is, if you like, the line bundle that's only supported on the subspace D. So this is a line bundle over D, and you extend it by zero to get a sheaf. Well, this obviously is the D-brain that wraps the whole of X. This is another D-brain that wraps the whole of X, but has got a different charge. It's a vector bundle which is not trivial. If I take that plus anti that, I get a D-brain which is supported only on D. And that's how I get my D-brains over subspaces. I get them for free once I do this construction. So OD is strictly speaking a coherent sheaf, and it's not a vector bundle in the strict sense of the word. And of course, DX consists of complexes. So in general, an element in DX looks like a complex of sheaves. And actually, you're free to declare that all these sheaves are vector bundles, at least if the case of X is smooth. Let me just go over slightly just to give the definition. So that's what a D-grain looks like. It's a complex of sheaves or vector bundles. So it's just a sequence of them such that the composition of two maps is zero. And then I just have to define a quasi-isomorphism. So suppose you give me two D-grains, two complexes. And suppose you give me vertical maps between all these corresponding pairs, such that this commutes. So that would be a chain map. This chain map is a quasi-isomorphism. Quasi-isomorphism, if it induces the identity on cohomology. So if you give me a complex mapping to another complex, I can compute the cohomology of the first row, the cohomology of the second row. I can compute the induced map on the cohomology. If that induced map is the identity, then this chain map is said to be a quasi-isomorphism. So then I can just simply state. Okay, I just have 10 more seconds than I've done. Yeah. The DX equals chain complexes modulo quasi isomorphism in 7 of 10. And that's it. So I'll stop there. Now, I've proven a rather abstract statement. Well, I haven't proven it, but I've given a sketch of it for proof of a rather abstract statement. In the next two talks, I'd like to give you more of a hint as to why this is a useful fact. So that's what I'll do next.